yesterday listed these items as among those awaiting collection. What's all this at its lost property office? A 25-pound cannonball, a 100-million-year-old fossil, a bag full of rotting seaweed, 200 maggots in a can, a glass eye, an artificial arm and hand, and a suitcase full of overripe bananas. All were left on the plane. Holy smokes. Oh, it's getting bad everywhere. Bad, bad. Except for the ticking of the small watch on his wrist, the dungeon beneath Freiburg Castle was deathly still. Watch seemed to clack faster with every complete turn of the second hand, faster as though to betray its owner, to hurry the death that would surely be his within the next hour, perhaps the next few minutes. The prisoner rose from his seat on a heap of human bones, yawned and stretched. In the dim gray light that filtered in through the slit 2 inches wide above his head, he glanced again at his watch. Nodded. Won't be long now, he ventured. If I know human nature, I'll win. If I don't, he shrugged and drew his finger in a significant gesture across his throat. The voice of the prisoner as he talked to himself seemed far too young for the old peasant that he appeared to be. When thrust into the cell the night before, he had been stooped and twisted with age. Now he stood erect. His face, still disguised with clever makeup, was the face of an old man, but the eyes were those of commanding youth. Gray, steel-hard eyes they were. Eyes with magnetic power to hold others. Unforgettable eyes. The watch ticked on. Death came closer at every second. Arrested as a spy, sentenced to be shot at 1 hour after dawn. But the young man, disguised as a peasant, smiled as he watched the light grow brighter through the slit above. A moment later, he laughed. Facing death, this man could laugh. Yes, he was different from others. He was blank, the young American spy. German voices lowered when they spoke of him, lowered their voices and cursed out of their breath. Blank seemed infallible, hardly human in his super skill. One great commanding general of the Imperial Army had said, "We must capture and kill this verdammt youth. We must kill him at all costs. I would give willingly 10,000 of my bravest men for his head. He is too clever to live. He knows more about our business now than we do ourselves." But now Blank was held captive, but by his own planning. He had flown a Spad over the Swiss-Franco border the evening before, had landed in Germany, dressed as a peasant, and when he could penetrate Freiburg Castle itself no farther, had permitted himself to be captured by the strong guard. Later, under rigid questioning by officers of the castle, he had permitted them to force an admission from him that he was indeed a spy. But only on one condition would he tell them by what name he was known to the American Secret Service. So far, the Germans had not complied with that request. All of this was part of a plan formed by Blank to learn something that he must know, something that was impossible to learn any other way. Suddenly, footsteps sounded down the dank, musty corridor leading to his cell. Clanking steps of hobnail boots. "I'd give 100 francs. Blank said to himself, still smiling, "to have a picture of their faces when I tell them who I am." I will award you a brass figmigee with bronze oak leaf palm with aluminum clusters for exceptional sagacity in rising above the muck and the mire of ordinary listenerdom if you can tell me what great character out of American fiction that character is. He made James Bond seem like one of the littlest Bobbsey twins. I'm serious. And furthermore, I would venture to say that the writer of James Bond, Ian Fleming, read a great deal of this character's life from Times before he put Bond down on paper. Now, you got some clues. What kind of an airplane did he fly over the German lines? A Spad, correct? So you know what war he worked in. Okay? You also know that he was not primarily a pilot. What was he? A spy. And you also know that he was known and feared by the other side, the opposition. Isn't this true of Bond? In other words, they always knew about, 707. He was a feared agent, wasn't he? 007, excuse me. He was a feared agent, was he not? I mean, you've read every last bit of Bond's work. He was feared, and they were always after him, weren't they? Nobody ever heard of 006. Who ever heard of 0012? It was 007 that they feared. Correct, Emil? All right. Now, that was part of the Bond myth. The Bond myth was that he had to be known to the other side to be really interesting as a character. If he was just an unknown spy who was happened to be a good spy, really active and very sharp at what he did, he wouldn't have been nearly as important. But the fact that everybody was watching for 007... some of the great characters that Bond created, or that Fleming created, they're kind of interchangeable, were nothing compared to the characters that this writer created. And incidentally, this writer wrote before anybody took stuff like spy stories seriously. And for that reason, his name is largely unknown. I would say it's unknown to almost everybody who's listening right now. What was the character? Now, let's see if you two guys in the control room know what I'm talking about. Who was he? Yes, but how did you know? You never read any of it. Yeah. You knew because I talked about it. That's right. You didn't know. Do you know, Matt? Well, do you want to hear another little episode? You want to hear a little more? That because you want to know what happened to him when they came to him. All right, give me a little of that mood music again, Matt, in there. You can't leave you hanging on the cliff. You know, here come the hobnail boots. They're going to execute him in right now. They're marching down this musty corridor in Freeburg Prison, which was a great prison camp for Allied flyers, incidentally, during World War I. Now, here's what happened. A light shone through the grated hole in the narrow, thick door. A round, close-cropped head appeared. Narrow eyes stared inside at blank. Then a great rusty key grated in the lock. Hinges creaked and groaned as the door moved. A huge German guard was straining at it with all his might. Blank at once stooped over, assumed the pose he had the evening before when brought in. The old stooped peasant. Through the half-open door, two figures glided. The first figure was a tall, slim, bemonocled German officer. He gave a short nod of his clipped head. Behind him came a chaplain carrying a black book. The officer spoke. "You are about to die, mein Herr," he said politely. "You will not tell us who you are?" Blank craned his head toward the end of his thrust forward neck. "I have given my answer to that," he said in a quavery voice. "But in case you have forgotten, I will repeat.
you, Herr Capitan, are only a tool in the hand of a mastermind. Take me to your leader. The man who does your thinking for you. Tell him I have something of interest for him. Then, and not until then, will I disclose who I actually am.
The German officer shook his head.
I tell you, mein Herr.
And the officer silenced him with a wave of his hand.
There is not, no one else commands here, other than I.
The officer turned.
I go now and leave you alone with the chaplain to prepare you for your death.
A crackling laugh came from the twisted lips of the peasant. Blank waved away the chaplain with one hand, clutched the arm of the officer with the other. He nodded to the astonished chaplain. It isn't that I do not honor your calling or our maker, G8 explained. It is that I am not ready to die. Not yet. Still stooped, he laughed into the officer's face.
Listen,
he hissed.
Listen. You lie about the man above you. Go tell him I have something to interest him. Concerning his secret tunnel through Switzerland.
The eyes of the officer opened wide. His mouth dropped. He stared dumbfounded at the peasant.
Gott in Himmel, he exploded. You know, Gott in Himmel.
Blank smile. Jawohl. Either I know or I'm a good guesser. Go tell the big boy what I said, and take this chaplain with you. He makes me nervous. It's a little ridiculous under the circumstances. He glanced at the slit above as the two moved hurriedly towards the door. And hurry. It's getting time for the shooting. I wouldn't want to miss that. So move. I like a good shooting at dawn. The two Germans left hurriedly. The German officer passed through the door behind the chaplain. He threw a last glance, a puzzled, questioning glance, at Blank as he went out. The door creaked shut with the big guard straining upon it as he'd done to open it. The key squawked and scratched in the lock. The sound of footsteps died away down the hall. And then silence once more. Blank waited. He die? Would he not? He smiled as he watched the sun mount high into the sky, sending a thin ray of light into his cell. Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This is WOI. In friendly old Fun City.
And now a special message from Dr. Pepper. The first Dr. Pepper truck has reached New York. We now switch you to our man on the street, Saul Weinberg, for a first-hand report.
Yes, it's true. The first Dr. Pepper truck has indeed arrived. The mood here is one of great excitement. Excuse me, please. People are cheering and screaming. Old and young alike. Watch the cable, please. United in one great gesture of welcome. I'm trying to get near the truck. Welcome. Welcome to New York.
How do you like it? Yes, Eddie, it's everything you said it would be.
Would you like to say something to our audience? How does it feel to be the first truck to make it through?
Speaking for the good of myself, we're kind of proud.
Hey, Mom, look, I made it.
Get out.
Well, there you have it. Some people said they'd never make it. But Dr. Pepper is in New York.
At the Plaza Theater in New York, a motion picture called Rider on the Rain is now in its premiere engagement. Already it is being hailed as a cinema masterpiece. Judith Crist of New York Magazine and NBC TV says,
Rider on the Rain is the complete movie, a totally absorbing and a stick-to-the-ribs-of-the-mind thriller. Rene Clément's film glitters with style and shines with technical accomplishment. It signals his mastery of the art of suspense drama, the gutsiest of melodramas with shocking impact, momentous happenings, and beautifully defined tensions. It is for those who wonder where the entertainment, the involvement, and the shared human experience of films have gone.
Joseph E. Levine presents an AFCO Embassy film starring Charles Bronson and Marlene Jobert, Rider on the Rain, directed by René Clément. In color, rated GP, all ages, parental guidance. Now playing Plaza Theatre.
Well, wasn't that exciting? Let's say, have you noticed every 20 minutes another film opens? It is the biggest thing since bottled beer. Sorry. You know, I wish I could get as excited about movies as other people. Really do. Now you, Matt, take you for example. I'll tell you, your whole life is lived reading photoplay. You have a look in the eye of a young man who thinks nothing is more exciting than Jane Fonda.
Oh, that's all right, honey. I know all about it, baby. Why do you keep pointing? What is it? You've developed the worst habit of pointing all over. What are you wanting me to do now? What are you pointing at? What's the matter? I know what time it is, and I know all about what commercials I've got to do. I know there's a tag on it. I mean, I know all that. Seven sakes. Here it is. That's a picture that Miss Crisp was all excited about. Has its American premiere Sunday at the Plaza Theater at 58th Street. That's east of Madison. All right? That's very good. I feel better now. By the way, that book that I was quoting from, listen to some of the great titles of chapters. The Bat's Breath. Now, that is a classic great title. The Bat's Breath. Think of that for a minute. I mean, the Bat's Breath. Think of the images that conjures up. Listen to this title now. Here's another. I'm just opening them at random. Find Him. Just a title of a chapter. Trapped. How do you like that one? You can just see the whole plot unfolding. Cave of the Bats. Okay. The Tunnel. These are all titles of chapters. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about the guy that wrote this. I don't know anything personal about him, except that there was one period in time, several years, when this writer was probably the most read writer, R-E-A-D, the most read writer, quite possibly, in the world. I don't know anything about his politics. You got to be careful. I could just see, you know, if I say he's the most read writer in the world, 15,000 people write in, four lawyers call up, and the next thing you know, I got a suit. No, it's R-E-A-D. This guy was read. And he wrote under at least six different names. He was one of the most prolific pulp writers of all time. And his work influenced and warped the minds of probably 27 billion people who are walking around today. And I might say also he influenced lots and lots of serious writers. You see, the key of being a good pulp writer is to be able to tell a story, a consummate story. In other words, running through the writer's work all the time is tension. Every scene is tension. And always in every scene is implied fantastic danger for the hero. Every scene. Not without the relapse. There is no point, and at no point does the hero ever lapse into long, involved, introspective inner monologues. Because, you see, when you got an inner monologue, there's no tension. There's just a guy blabbing away. In other words, Portnoy is not, and never would qualify in the storytelling art. It just isn't a story. It's a long quest, but it ain't a story. Now, in the case of a good pulp writer, the story is preeminent. And in every story that is written by pulp guys, really a good pulp writer, is that there is a well-defined objective which is stated right at the beginning that X, the hero, and Ian Fleming was a pulp writer. Ian Fleming is a classic example of a pulp writer. So right at the beginning of every James Bond story, M would summon Bond to the office and tell him, "We have information that Dr. No, an obscure doctor in an island in the Caribbean, is about to destroy the world. Only one person stands between the destruction of the world as we know it, and God knows what, but you." Bum, ba-dum, bum. Now, that's the well-defined objective right there at the beginning. Now, what happens is that one man, always in one of these pulp fiction thrillers, hurls himself at what appears to be an impregnable machine. Now, the machine itself has to be fantastic to have him say, "We are going to send you out to Indian Russell with another German spy." That's nothing, you know. You got two guys, and you tend to relate them with the other guy, you see. You got to know who's good and bad in these things. And so, always, the other machine is impregnable. Dr. No was on an impregnable island, and he had thousands of paid machine gun-equipped dacoits, zombies, who destroyed anybody who came within 15,000 feet of the impenetrable island. And, of course, he had infinite resources at his command. This is important. Now, when he went after, Goldfinger, as they kept saying, "Goldfinger!" Ooh, I heard that thing till I was ready to throw up, if I may quote Dorothy Parker. "Goldfinger!" have you noticed how Bronx accents are getting to be popular in every commercial you ever see? The Ford Mustang. Practically every announcer who's making it these days has got a Bronx accent, very strong one. But nevertheless, it's well-defined. You know, the pulp thing, it has to be well-defined. Ian Fleming was a classic pulp writer. Now, only in our time of decaying values would a writer like Fleming be taken seriously as a writer. Had he written his stuff in 1936, we'll say, he wouldn't have been any better than Argosy, whoever wrote the Doc Savage, same scene, you know. Whoever took, let's say, S.S. Van Dyne seriously as a writer in the 30s. And yet I noticed the other day, curiously enough, Richard Watts of the Post reread the Bishop murder case, which was S.S. Van Dyne. And he had a little line in there. He says, "I reread the Bishop murder case," and he says, "it's a genuine classic." He says, "As a matter of fact, they just..." Philo Vance is such a fantastic snob. Nevertheless...
This...
Never read it. If you've never read any other mystery, it'll tell you...
This is the Bemis Recording Corporation. We are having technical difficulties. Please stand by. This is the Bemis Recording Corporation. We are having technical difficulties. Please stand by. The entire program will proceed in one moment. Thank you. Studio 9, we now return you to the Gene Shepherd program, which is now in progress. We are sorry for the technical difficulties which took place, which were not under our control. This is the Bemis Recording Corporation, signing off and returning you to the Gene Shepherd program. Thank you.
That there are even posters out now about the Red Baron. And invariably, they show him as some kind of a gorilla sitting in the plane looking evil and so on. And yet, The actual Red Baron was the epitome of the elegant, wasp-waisted, handsome, chivalrous Prussian officer. He was the very epitome of it. In fact, you know that what the Red Baron did once, in case any of you guys are out there interested in the Red Baron, he was famous for a couple of exploits that were common at the time he was beginning his career. Among other things, he shot a guy down once, just right about within his first four or five victories. He shot a man down, and he saw the plane go in, the plane that he shot down, it crashed. With that, he circled and landed and made sure that the troops around there gave the guy first aid. In other words, he made sure that the guy was okay, gave him first aid. He then got back into his aircraft and took off. That's a true exploit. It was doing things like this, by the way, that made him the fantastic legend that he was, among other things. And, you know, there's been of course, we could go on and on about Richthofen. How many of you know that Baron von Richthofen's sister? Now, I'll give you a real piece of trivia. To whom was Baron von Richthofen's sister, and her name was Richthofen, too, of course, von Richthofen, her name was Frieda. To whom was she married? A very famous man. In fact, she appears in a great number of his works in one form or another. Now, this is a literary question for you. Well, I'll tell you. D.H. Lawrence. That'll... Yeah, she was married to D.H. Lawrence. And, in fact, there is some theory about the fact that she could very well be the lady in Lady Chatterley. Are you aware of that, Lee? Because, you see, she was from a noble family. And she was this elegant beauty. And she came from a very haughty family, very high, tremendous Prussian status. They were elegant. It was Baron von Richthofen, you know. The Red Baron was a real baron. And this was not just a title they called him. And incidentally, the term Red Baron was applied to him only by the press. That term was rarely ever used. In fact, nobody ever used it, actually, among the flyers. It was just a title they applied to him. Like the press, you know, like the Daily News always tends to give somebody some jazzy nickname. Instantly, no matter what president is in, they come up with a nickname for him, you know. And I'm sure this is the way it went. He was called the Red Baron. Now, the reason he was called the Red Baron, of course, was because of the aircraft that he flew at one point in his career, which was red. Now, a lot of people think that he painted his plane red because that made it evil and all. No, not at all. It was a matter of identification that they were having trouble. His Staffel, his squadron, was having trouble from time to time in identifying each other in this tremendous melee of a dogfight. So they decided to have their planes painted individual colors so they could detect when the red plane is the leader, you see. And the green plane is his wingman. The yellow plane is his left wingman, and so on down the line. So that became very, very dramatic in the front. Of course, in the newspaper. You want to hear another little story about him? Another interesting thing. He was not shot down in the red plane. When he was finally shot down, the aircraft that he was shot down in was not his regular aircraft, and it was a maroon aircraft. It was painted maroon, and he was not shot down by Captain Roy Brown of the Canadian Air Force, contrary to popular opinion that there are too many witnesses, in fact, thousands of witnesses on the ground that maintain, and there is a lot of evidence to prove it, including medical evidence, that he was shot down by a shot from the ground. He was flying at only about 150, 200 feet off the ground, and he was hit by a machine gun slug, which came from behind, from underneath. The actual path of the bullet traveled from the ground up. So when his body was recovered, they discovered that he was shot from the ground, never from a Canadian Air Force. And, of course, why this rumor has persisted was that for the benefit of propaganda, people wanted to build their own ace, you see. So they credited it to Roy Brown, who happened to be in the area, and who was, at that time, just before that, did pursue the plane and had given up the pursuit because the aircraft was outdistancing him. But that's a long story, and we're going to open another can of peas.
But this particular character, do you want to hear another line? Any line you take, now I'm just opening this up at any point. Any point of a good pulp story, you will find it grabs you. It's a grabber. Listen to this, man. Now, I've just opened it up at random. Give me a little of that music on. No, set it back. Now, that's the end of it. Just to reset it there. And while you're doing that, Big Matt, I want to again remind you, you guys out there, listen, please don't, I repeat, do not continue to call the station. If you have not ordered your year one poster, get on the stick. This is a fantastic poster. It really is a great poster. And I would not steer you wrong. You've seen this, haven't you, Matt? For $2, it makes one of the wildest things you can hang in your room. And by the way, it's a darn good work of art. If you're interested in a surrealist painting, it's a surrealist poster in beautiful lithographed colors. I don't know how many colors this are, but this thing must be at least 10 colors. It is not a little cheapy bit, and it's fascinating, an interesting piece of work, and I suspect it's highly symbolic to most people. The longer you look at this poster, the more things you'll see in it. It just turns on. And incidentally, it's also day glow, which is to say that if you turn on the right kind of lights, a lot of stuff shows up that do not show up in the light of day. This poster, and it is a remarkable piece of work for $2. And it's sold in no stores, so you won't find it down at the bookstore, so forget it. If you think you're going to trot down and ask them for the year one poster, you will not get it. This is the only place you'll hear of it, right here, period. Now, if you'd like to order one of these, just drop a check or a money order to the tune of $2, which is about what you'd pay for a cheeseburger and a root beer. $2, send it to, and here's the address, Year One. Year One, 460 West 34th Street, New York, New York. I repeat, don't send it to the station, please. Send it to Year One, 460 West 34th Street, New York, New York. And I'll guarantee you personally that you'll get your dough back if your mind is not blown. Personally, you can hear minds popping all over Jersey. So, again, I repeat, don't call up the station. I'll give you a clue on this thing. There's a little tiny anagram at the bottom that stands for Heaven, Earth, Rock, Beatles, Sound, Time. Come together at the Kingdom of Rock. And it makes it. I'll just guarantee you. Year One, and it's got a lot to say. It's one of the few posters I've seen that actually says something. It's worthwhile having. $2, Year One, 460 West 34th Street, New York, New York. Okay? And, you know, while we're on the subject of... I don't know how I happened to get on this idea of pulp fiction, but, you know, I picked up a copy of this. I was amazed to see that they brought out some of this stuff again. And I hope, I hope a few people who are interested in writing pick it up, because this guy, this writer, is one of the best examples of pure storytelling in the classic pulp tradition. Now, here, I'll just open it up at random, and here, way in the back, is a typical chapter. Blank grew tense as he stood there before the place where Kapitan Schlosser had lain. He glanced at his wristwatch. He had been gone a little more than an hour. Bending down, he drew a finger through the blood. It was fresh, just beginning to thicken. The body couldn't have been moved more than 15 minutes or possibly 20. Body! Body! The idea suddenly smote him a stunning blow. He had concealed Schlosser, for he was reasonably sure no one could find him. He had felt the heart. There had been no beating as far as he could tell. He leaped to his feet. Body! Perhaps Kapitan Schlosser had not been dead. He couldn't swear, but of course, his heart had ceased to beat to all appearances, but there was no assurance of actual certain death. He stood rigid. A sense of danger crept over him, a sense that he could not explain or describe. His first warning came with a gentle scraping of a boot heel on stone. He spun around. His hand flashed for his Luger. His eyes focused on a bloody figure swaying a little against a great boulder. Schlosser himself stood there, a Luger in his hand. Anger and hatred,
flamed in his eyes. Blank reached for his gun. He froze for a split second. Training, natural ability, and perfect self-control came to his aid instantly. He dropped his hands to his side and broke off a laugh that sounded genuine. Ah, ah, Capitan Schloss, you startled me. You have been hurt. Hurt, you understand, hurt. Schlosser shook his head as though to send the fog, the blood from his brain. But the deadly Luger remained trained on Blank. He stared hard at the master spy, his eyes clotted with blood from the wound on his head, narrowed to slits. What is this, another trick? He missed. Ah, my cough, my head hurts. What did you do? Blank nodded. His face took on a serious look. Yes, that is your trouble, Herr Capitan. Your head, perhaps your memory has been affected.
Memory. Akimmel. Akimmel, yes. The plans. Where are the plans?
His bloody body swayed as he appeared about to lose consciousness. His eyes glazed. Akimmel. He sank to the ground. A little fell from his lifeless fingers.
What a scene.
Fuck him up.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to confess something to you. I get letters probably every week from people who say, what radio program influenced you as a kid? And I have to admit, none. I didn't listen to the radio. I'm serious. I have felt for years that there are two kinds of people, listeners and doers. And from the very beginning of your life, you are either a listener or a doer. In other words, from the time he was probably five, Laurent Olivier saw himself as an actor, not as a member of the audience. Roger Maris never saw himself as a guy sitting back at third base eating hot dogs, watching ball games. He saw himself as sitting down in the dugout, spitting on his shoe, getting ready to take a swing. That's a different process. And I never listened to the radio. Rarely, as a kid. What did I do? Well, I played baseball, football, all of it. Had fist fights. But I had one weakness. One weakness. When I was a paper boy, the place where we picked up our papers was operated by a guy named George the Greek. And he had the local paper agency. And old George would stand back at the counter there, and he would send us out every day. There were about 10 of us kids. We had paper routes. Well, he also had a big rack of magazines. Tremendous rack. And we would sit on the floor at like 5 o'clock in the morning before George the Greek would open up for the general public, and we would fold our papers, all the paper kids, it'd be about 10 of us, see, folding our papers in these little tight, hardened envelopes, you know. But incidentally, one of the great secret sources of satisfaction in my life was the time that I really learned how to fold papers as fast as it takes to even just glance at them, you know, into the sack. And we're packing up the papers. Well, I am sitting one day packing papers, and I noticed on my left a magazine. I was not a reader either as a kid, particularly. Off to my left, I see this magazine. And on the cover of the magazine was an airplane, a wild-looking aircraft, and it was painted yellow with a big number 7 on the side of it. On this aircraft, and it was a SPAD, beautiful picture of an airplane. Now, any kid is a sucker, a boy type, for pictures of airplanes. And I see this picture of the airplanes. And it was burning. The aircraft had been shot down. It was going down in flames. And the pilot was hanging over the cockpit, and you could see the blood streaming back on the side of the fuselage. And this picture got me. I saw it, see, and I folded up my papers. Dawn is just coming up. Dawn is coming up, see. And I'm sitting there folding my papers, little realizing that I'm about to have a psychic
traumatic experience that was going to affect an entire artistic performance for a thousand years to come. And as I'm folding my papers, my hand lashes out like a hooded cobra, as fast as the eye can move. Yeah, like that. I grab one of George's magazines, stick it in my paper, which I am folding up, and I have just stolen a magazine. It was the first job that I pulled. I stole a magazine with a picture of a yellow spad on the cover. Stick it down, and I had never read this magazine before. That night, when I got home from school, I went in my front bedroom. See, I figured it was a dirty magazine. I go in my front bedroom, but it had a picture of an airplane on the front, a yellow spad that was crashing in flames. And I picked up that first page. I looked at it, see, and I said, gee, there's no pictures of airplanes hardly in here. It's just a lot of writing. You know, if there's anything a kid hates, it's writing. I picked it up, and I looked at one line, the opening line. It said, "The flames spouted from the burning engine. The pilot, his body streaming blood in the wicked wind stream as the plane crashed out of control. The master spy was dead." Swoop! Master spy sped, crashing flames. I read that magazine in 12 and a half microseconds. From that month on, I stole every copy of this magazine I could lay my hands on. Some days, there were more stolen magazines in my paper bag than papers. The name of this fantastic character? G8. The Master Spy. A spy who headed his own secret squadron of spads. The Master Flying Spy. There it is. And this, by the way, this novel is called G8 and the Bat Staffel, or the Bat Squadron. The writer, a classic writer in the pulp genre, Robert J. Hogan, who wrote the incredible exploits of G8 and his battle aces. The blood streamed as the spads soared out of the sky.